This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you live in Florida, you'll soon have the right to use a gun or other deadly means to protect yourself in public places. Under the previous law, citizens could meet force with force only if there was no safe way to escape. The new Stand Your Ground law changes that equation. Advocates, including the National Rifle Association, argue that people have the right to defend themselves if attacked and shouldn't have to worry about the legal consequences. Opponents, including some police organizations, worry that the new law will encourage people to shoot first and ask questions later. Most states have what's known as the Castle Doctrine. That allows people to use deadly force to protect themselves if attacked inside their homes, but Florida now joins a smaller number of states that extend the Castle Doctrine to public places, including the office, the car, or out on the street. And after success in Tallahassee, the NRA promises to lobby for similar legislation in every other state capital. Later in the program, we'll hear what embattled lobbyist Jack Abramoff has to say about Congress, Tom DeLay, and ethics. But first, self-defense and the law. Where do you draw the line? We'd be especially interested to hear from those of you in law enforcement or those of you who may have faced this kind of situation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go first to Florida to learn a little bit more about this new law. Leslie Clark is political reporter for the Miami Herald and joins us from the State Capitol building in Tallahassee. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Neil.
This bill passed overwhelmingly in the state legislature.
It did, in both houses. Passed unanimously in the Senate and by a huge majority, 94 to 20 in the House.
Was there one outstanding case, one issue that made this, that answers that question about its popularity?
I guess just the NRA's popularity in the state of Florida, probably. There was no case that anyone cited that sort of spurred it on.
Was there any substantial opposition to it?
No, there was very little opposition to it. It moved quickly, sort of under the radar, moved in the sort of the beginning of the session and without a lot of attention, and there was not much organized opposition to it other than some couple of Democrats in the House who warned that the passing the bill would turn Florida into something akin to the Wild Wild West.
Well, a little bit later in the program, we'll hear from one of the sponsors of the legislation and from an opponent there in Florida. But let me ask you, how does the bill change existing Florida law on self-defense?
Well, under current law, you have to have made at least a reasonable effort to retreat if someone comes at you with what you believe is deadly force. You have to have at least some sort of made an attempt to leave. Under this law, under the change in the law, you no longer have that duty to retreat.
Is there, subsequent to the signing of the law last week, has there been any controversy?
I'm sorry?
Has any controversy developed since the bill was signed into law last week?
Yeah, in that the NRA has said that it plans to go state house by state house and try to get the law in most of the other states. But it hasn't gone. It goes into the governor signed it into law last week. It goes into effect in October. And it's been debated a lot, but it hasn't really resulted in anything yet.
And Florida is one of the states where carrying weapons in public is allowed?
Yeah, you were already allowed to carry a concealed weapon in Florida. And you also, if you live in a state, if you carry a gun in another state that allows concealed weapons, you can also carry it here. Florida Governor Jeb Bush in 1999 signed a reciprocity agreement, which allows people to come in and carry concealed weapons.
And did we summarize the arguments for and against the bill fairly correctly, do you think?
I think so. People against it thought that it would turn it into the Wild West. Other people who were for it say that, you know, they want that criminals to know that if they are ready to assault somebody, that they've got to be ready to be assaulted right back.
Leslie Clark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Leslie Clark, a political reporter for the Miami Herald, and she joined us from the State Capitol building in Tallahassee. Joining us now to discuss some of the legal concepts behind the ideas of self-defense and the duty to retreat is George Fletcher, Cardozo Professor of Jurisprudence at the Columbia University School of Law, and he joins us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Now, Florida is not the only state to have this expansion of the Castle Doctrine, right?
Well, that's correct, but I wouldn't exaggerate the significance of this. I think it's greatly overplayed. It's largely a symbolic victory for the NRA, but I don't think it's going to make much of a difference in practice.
The police chiefs who argued against it thought differently.
Well, that is interesting. I'm not exactly sure what they're afraid of. It might be that they're concerned about people who would initiate aggressive action and then try to cover up more easily under a claim of self-defense. But I didn't actually hear any substantial argument on the side of the police chief.
Now, I wonder, self-defense, this has always been a fundamental concept in the law, correct?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, we've always had a principle of self-defense. And since the early 16th century, it's been permissible to stand your ground and shoot robbers on the highway. This has never been a matter of much controversy. But only in the 20th century, we started thinking about solicitude for the interests of aggressors, and therefore the Model Penal Code recommended the duty to retreat as a way of trying to minimize the danger that would occur in these aggressive conflicts.
Now, going into that just a little bit, in other words, if you are the victim of an aggressor, your first obligation under the old law was to seek a way to retreat.
Well, I don't think you can correctly say the old law. I mean, we're talking about three different stages. There's a traditional rule, and then there's the 20th century emphasis on the duty to retreat. And now we see this reaction back to the idea of the right to stand your ground. But even traditionally, there was no – even the under the rule to retreat, you couldn't apply it very strictly. I mean, it's, the requirement is there had to be a reasonable alternative. But what is a reasonable alternative? I mean, you can't exactly turn your back and run. I mean, you increase the danger to yourself by doing that. And Oliver Wendell Holmes said in a brilliant line once that detached reflection cannot be expected in the face of an uplifted knife. That means you can't really think reasonably and carefully about your options. Therefore, the reasonable thing to do frequently is simply to stand your ground and to fight back.
And even in states where the first obligation might have been legally to retreat, how have courts actually interpreted this? I mean,
Well, actually, I don't know of any cases in which a defendant has been convicted because he did not retreat enough or the retreat doctrine actually led to a conviction. You remember the case of Bernhard Goetz that was tried here in New York about 15 years ago. The subway vigilante who entered the subway car and sat down amid four guys who were carrying on and creating a big ruckus. The prosecutor at one point said, you know, Goetz could have solved this problem simply by moving to the other end of the car. And I wrote a book about this case and interviewed the jury subsequently, and some of the jurors were offended at the idea that Goetz would have to change his seat. That would be like retreating in order to avoid the problem. That is, he had a right to sit where he wanted to sit. That's the kind of thing that the Florida law is talking about. So at the level of individual rights, I think that basically Florida is doing the right thing. This is the correct position to take, but that doesn't mean that I favor a symbolic victory for the NRA.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Following the approval of a new law in Florida, we're talking about self-defense and the law. Our guest is George Fletcher of Columbia University Law School. Let's talk with Frank, and Frank joins us on the phone from Jacksonville in Florida.
How you doing?
All right.
Good show.
Thank you.
See, the main thing about this bill, and I'm holding it in my hand, is Section 4. We've already had all of these laws already in Florida. It's just that you had to look them up. Section 4 states, a person who uses force as permitted is granted immunity from criminal prosecution and civil prosecution for action that's justifiable in the use of force. And that's the whole thing. Now, the criminal can't sue me and the cops can't arrest me if I defend myself. And that's
the correct
main thrust of this bill.
Right. But you see, changing the language on the duty to retreat doesn't basically change the fundamental requirements of self-defense. It still has to be necessary for you to use force.
No,
of course, that's right.
This isn't a new thing.
This is not a new thing. I agree with you completely. No, I don't think that the statute really changes anything. It's largely symbolic. It's a way of saying you have the right to be where you are. You can stand your ground. You don't have to run away in order to protect the aggressor.
Yeah, but you can't. Before, you could be sued for it. Now you can't be. Mm-hmm.
Well, the standards in criminal cases and in civil cases are exactly the same, except that the burden of proof is different in civil cases, and you couldn't be sued for it. You couldn't be sued if you were justified.
Well, Frank, do you see this as simply symbolic?
No, of course not. Because I've been here for 26 years, and 20 of those years I've had a concealed weapons permit. All right, and it used to be in this state that the concealed weapons permit was only good county to county. It's only in the past 10 years that it's been good in the whole state.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a different law that we're talking about.
Yeah, but it all comes down under the same thing. It's the use of deadly force in lawful self-defense. I mean, it's put out here by Charles Bronson, the Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. It's right.
I don't think there's any. There's no state in the country in which you would be arrested and convicted if you use deadly force to protect yourself against an imminent threat to your life or bodily security.
I don't know. You read the newspapers, and it looks a little different.
Well, Frank, what about you personally? You've carried a concealed weapon, you say, for some time.
Of course.
And has this ever come up?
Of course it has. Especially in Florida, because you have to down here. The police aren't there when the action happens. I'm the one that's there when something happens.
You mean you've pulled your gun and used it?
I've pulled my gun, and it saved my life twice in this state.
Uh-huh.
By brandishing it or by using it?
By brandishing it, of course.
Well,
in self-defense of my property and myself.
Well, that's good, so long as you didn't have to use it. That was true in the Getz case, too.
Well, if I had to use it, then God bless this new law that exempts me from prosecution, doesn't it?
I would just expect that. It would be nice if you had a witness, whatever the circumstances.
Well, see, if I can prove that I needed to use deadly force, I don't need a witness.
Well, actually, the burden is always on the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you didn't have the right of self-defense. So you don't have to prove anything.
And that's a nice thing about this law, that this makes it that much simpler for me, doesn't it?
Actually, I disagree with you on that, Frank. I don't think it makes anything simpler, but if you feel better, more power to you.
Well, I do. Thank you.
Frank, Good. Thanks for the call, and let's hope you don't have to ever pull it again.
Well, thank you very much.
We're talking about Florida's new Stand Your Ground law and the history of self-defense and the law. When we come back, we'll hear from both sides of the debate in the Florida State House and more with our guest George Fletcher of the Columbia University School of Law. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Florida has a new law which allows citizens to meet attackers on the street with deadly force instead of trying to escape as their first responsibility. Today on the program, the history and legal theory behind such laws. What do you think? Where do you draw the line? We especially want to hear from law enforcement officers in our audience. What happens when you have to make a split-second decision about the use of deadly force? Our number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is George Fletcher, professor of jurisprudence at Columbia University Law School in New York. He's at our bureau in New York City. And we're going to hear now from two legislators from Florida involved in last week's passage of the Stand Your Ground bill. First with us is Representative Dennis Baxley, a Republican of Ocala, who sponsored the bill. He's stepped off the floor at the House session of the State Capitol building in Tallahassee to join us. Thanks for taking the time.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thank you.
Why was this extension of the Castle Doctrine important to you?
Well, I think it's a whole movement here to try to stand firmly against crime. And there was three aspects to this bill, the home protection and self-defense bill. The first part is to canonize this Castle Doctrine because it was not in state statute. It was being interpreted by case law, and we felt like it was important to stand with victims of violent crime. The second part of it was to extend that to the automobile. This modern era has really created the advent of the car invasion. And then the third part is most violent attacks that occur, you're in some place that you have a right to be, but it may be on a side street or on your way to your vehicle or something. And we felt like it was important to move away from this duty to retreat and move towards a posture that says when you're under a violent attack and you're in danger of losing your life or serious bodily harm, that we should stand with that victim of violent attack and say that, if you can, you can stand your ground and save your life.
Was there a case that inspired this, or was this just a matter of principle as far as you saw?
I think it's just a matter more of transition and principle that we've felt the number of movements to in the courts that are more defensive of the criminal's position, more protective of them. And we felt like the duty to retreat was just too much. Actually, there's only about 10 states that have a duty to retreat provision in their law. And so I'm kind of surprised this was such groundbreaking news, because we're really just catching up with a lot of other states.
And it proved very popular in the legislature. I mean, you say courts that seem to be siding with the criminals rather than the victims. From what I've read, every court in Florida was extending the Castle Doctrine to cover cases where it happened in the workplace and places like that.
Well, what we don't know about, though, is there's been so many times that people are waiting for months to see if they're going to be cleared. We had a recent victim of the hurricane that was staying in their RV. Some people broke in. And, you know, they're there to avoid something, looting of their property. This person broke in on them in the RV, and it was several months before this guy knew he wouldn't be charged with something. I don't think victims of violent attacks should be treated as quasi-criminals until they can prove themselves innocent.
Well, let's get another listener involved in the conversation. This is Jack, and Jack's calling from Santa Clara in California.
Yes, good morning. Professor, your guest mentioned that, you know, in law enforcement personnel, and I have over 10 years of experience as a police officer as well as 15 years in the military, there is a level of training that allows individuals with firearms to make decisions under stress. And having trained soldiers to decide to shoot or not to shoot when they're engaged, I've always found that training wins out in a stressful situation. My greatest concern is to have citizens with weapons who are then faced with a stressful, potentially life-threatening situation, and they don't have the training to overcome their basic fears. And therefore, they're putting not only themselves at risk, but, you know, potentially innocent bystanders, even members of their family.
Well, let's ask Representative Baxley for a response to that.
Well, I think it's very important to remember that there are over 20,000 gun laws dealing with weaponry in this country, and those are still in effect. We're not negating that. And, in fact, under that whole provision, you really shouldn't have a firearm on your possession unless you have a permit to carry. Out of the close to a million that have been issued so far since we passed that law in 87, less than 1/10,000th of a percent have ever had any problem and had to have their permit removed. This tells me that we're dealing with a very responsible, trained group of people, and we're just going to stand with them if they're under a violent attack.
We had the
same hysterical reaction whenever we passed that in 1987, and you know what happened? Violent crime went down.
Jack, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yes. And we'll get to you, Professor, in just a minute.
No, and I can agree with the professor on that. My basic concern still remains that you're opening the door to potential civilian shooting situations where the training just isn't there. But the professor does raise a reasonable statistic, and I believe that there are probably people who are, you know, well trained.
Mm-hmm.
Again, my concern still remains that while I may have the necessary training, I'm more concerned about the other individual in the street, the car next to me, or even in my own neighborhood, who decides that they're going to open fire on an individual because they feel threatened.
Jack.
Well, and I think we need to move to a little closer to what the bill says. You know, it's not just a feeling threatened. It's exactly being under attack and being able to justify that there was reasonable cause to know that you were facing imminent death or serious bodily injury, and you're limited to meeting force with force. In other words, if they're just yelling at you, then all you can do is yell back. I don't care how frightened you are. If they're actually attacking you to kill you, then you can defend yourself rather than turning and trying to run. and perhaps suffering more serious injury.
Professor,
I hope to minimize the number of victims. That's what I'm after.
Professor Fletcher?
Well, actually, I hear both sides actually speaking to the same point, that gun permits, regulations, testing to see whether people are competent to carry weapons is a way of ensuring the public safety. And I think they're both right. But just to clarify certain points about this statute, first of all, it's not correct that it's just force with force, that if a woman is facing a risk of rape, she can obviously kill to defend herself. And secondly, the statute does require, every law in self-defense requires that the response be necessary under the circumstances. So if there is some easy way to step into an elevator and avoid the attack, whether there's a provision on duty to retreat or not, if you can avoid the situation just by stepping into the elevator, then that means that the use of force is not necessary under the circumstances. That's a fundamental rule every place.
There's nothing in this bill that requires you to stand your ground.
I mean,
if you have a good way to escape, most of us will and should.
Well, the first line in the statute requires that the response be necessary. And every statute and every law of self-defense requires that you avoid the use of unnecessary force. So if you can solve the problem, let's say a guy is coming at you in a wheelchair and he's carrying a sword, all you have to do is step aside, or some blind man is trying to stab you with a knife, you just step aside. Obviously, you should be required to do that as a matter of basic decency.
Most of these cases are not people in wheelchairs and blind
people. No, of course not.
But out to
the most important thing you said, though, is that there was no serious case in Florida that stimulated any of this. And the fact of the matter is...
Well, on the other hand, we don't know who's sitting in jail convicted. They're listed as a felon when they were defending themselves.
Well, in your case of the RV person, for example, that's the cloud of 2 months might still prevail, because you would have to find out whether the use of force was necessary under the circumstances. What if they just said, go away? Go away would have been enough under the circumstances. That's clearly the right thing to do.
Well, and I think you've definitely captured the crux of the matter. Do you want to put the presumption with the victim, who has maybe 3 seconds to make a decision if they want to live or die, or do you want to put it with prosecutors who have 2 or 3 months to sit around and speculate about how you might have handled the situation?
Well, it's obviously important.
I think you can see where I am.
Yeah, of course, I agree with you completely. The prosecution has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and guilt includes the question whether you acted in self-defense. This is now well established all over the United States.
Well, I think it's also important to remember there's a lot of places where other things take effect. I've heard about bar fights. It's illegal to take a weapon in a bar in Florida. I've heard about stadium fights, soccer games. We have all kinds of places that do not allow firearms to be present.
I think that's excellent.
That control that.
Excellent. All of these are very important measures to ensure the public safety. So controlling the use of weapons and the presence of weapons in the society is a much smarter approach than trying to tinker with the law of self-defense. Now, getting rid of the duty to retreat is a bargain that we have to strike with the NRA in order to get better gun regulations about guns in bars and public places, I'm all for it. That's fine. Allow a symbolic victory, but maintain your permit laws the way you do in Florida.
Representative Baxley, thanks very much, and congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation today.
Dennis Baxley, Republican of Ocala, sponsored the Stand Your Ground bill that passed last week in Florida, and he joined us from the State Capitol building in Tallahassee. Now let's move the other side of the building, I suspect. Representative Dan Gelber, Democrat of Miami Beach, voted against the passage of that bill. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So why did you oppose this bill?
Well, first of all, I've listened to a good part of the last discussion. There's really been no victim in Florida of the current law. The current law in Florida of self-defense is very typical, which basically says, I guess the best way to describe it is it codifies common sense. You can stand your ground and meet force with force, but you have a duty to retreat if you can retreat safely. That's literally what the codified jury instructions say. And in fact, they codify the Castle Doctrine as well, no duty to retreat applies to your home. And that's been the law in Florida for a long time, and it's served prosecutors, which I was one, quite well. What this does, and where I think I depart slightly from the professor's reading of it, is that it eliminates a duty to retreat that has heretofore been part of our codified jury instructions. And that will mean something to prosecutors who say, well, up to now, if somebody chose to stick around when they really could have walked away, that was a way in which I could attach a liability for a homicide. Mm-hmm. But now, because the legislature has affirmatively said you have no duty to retreat, that must mean something. It's not symbolic. It's actual. And I think that, you know, current law allowed you to stand with victims who acted reasonably. But this creates a no duty to retreat in public, which I think is very troublesome.
How would it change?
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
I mean, I don't really think that you're right about a good prosecutor will be able to prosecute and convict under the same circumstances with the same efficacy. All you have to do is emphasize the question whether the response was necessary. You know, take my hypotheticals, the blind man, the guy in the wheelchair, where the response is not necessary. It doesn't matter whether there's any jury instruction about retreating or not retreating. So it's just a matter of how the prosecutor changes the rhetoric used at trial. I don't think it's going to, if you're wedded to this particular language, maybe it'll have an influence. But if you're clever in the courtroom, it shouldn't.
Well, that's great, because what that means is when you don't have the situation of somebody in a carjack where somebody's an obvious victim, mm-hmm. but you have the altercation, which is escalating words to shoves to fists to something where somebody reasonably could say somebody could actually hurt me, because you don't have to kill somebody under the new law. You just have to feel reasonably that you subjectively were in fear of your life or great bodily injury like a punch, which, by the way, uniformly in Florida state courts is considered possibly going to impact grave bodily injury. What that means is you want your prosecutors to be really clever to find a way to get something that we all agree ought to be illegal conduct into the laws. Why would you give a defense to somebody who can stand up and say, wait a second, the law says by statute, I had every right to stay there, even though I could have closed the elevator door, even though I could have walked away, even though I could have done 10 other things. The statute the legislature passed, which trumps all the jury instructions from the Supreme Court, says I have no duty to retreat, right, even if I could safely retreat, which is what the law was until we passed it. So, you know, I appreciate that we can ask our prosecutors to, in a very clever way and creative way, wordsmith their way into convictions. But why would we want to do that when the current law was a clear reflection of what all of us know ought to be the law and what is common sense, which is if you can safely walk away from an altercation, you ought to do it.
We're talking about Florida's new Stand Your Ground law. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's bring a listener into the conversation. This is Rick, and Rick's calling us from Nevada.
Yes, I am. I'm a law enforcement officer and a chief of police out here, and I support the I don't want to call it stand your ground, but the ability to defend yourself. I don't believe that a person should have a duty to retreat. I've been a victim of a couple crimes with my family and could not retreat. Although to someone else, they might have said, you could have walked away, you could have done this. And they weren't in the situation with me. And I don't think a citizen or his family should have to retreat when they're going about their business. I think they have the right to go about their business and do their thing without being victimized by violent criminals.
Are you at all concerned about people who don't have the training that you do with weapons?
Well, in order to get a concealed permit in this state and every other state that I've ever looked at, you have to have some training to do that. I'm also an instructor in the use of deadly force, and the first thing I teach people is avoidance. Stay away from it, stay out of it, and then you don't have to make the choice of defending yourself or not defending yourself or retreating. I do believe in avoidance.
Okay.
And we all have a tremendous amount of intuitive feelings that we know a bad situation when we see one or feel one or hear one.
See, I think that there's an issue of principle behind all of this that influences the debate, and that's why it's a major issue in the culture war, so to speak. And that is, if you're attacked, do you have to worry about the interests of the aggressor? Are you, as it were, in the boat together? So you have to try to protect the interests of the aggressor by retreating, if that's the only way to save the life of the aggressor. Well, I think one of the things that the law is trying to say is, you know, you don't have to think about the interests of the aggressor. If it's necessary to respond, you're entitled to respond. That's been the traditional law, ever since people have been writing about this.
I have a different view of this. You know, I was a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor for a long time. My wife is one. My father was one. My sister and brother-in-law are one.
We just have a few seconds, Representative Galbraith.
It's just this simple. Why would you know, two guys are in an altercation, and neither of them are really criminals. Shouldn't we command that if they can walk away, they can? And under this new jury instruction, under this new statute, we simply are telling them you don't have to exercise the same sensible judgment we tell our kids to when they're confronted with the same situation. And as a prosecutor, as a former prosecutor, I don't know why we would give people who caused that kind of tragedy the benefit of a jury instruction that really wasn't intended for them.
Rick, thanks for the call. And Representative Galbraith, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to continue our conversation about self-defense and the law after the break. And this is NPR News. Today we're talking about self-defense laws. In most states, victims of assault can respond with deadly force when attacked in their homes. What about in their cars or on the street? Our guest is George Fletcher, a professor at Columbia University Law School in New York City. And let's get some more callers on the line. And this is Eric. Eric's with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My incident occurred a couple of years ago where I was asleep in my home in Reno and just out of the blue woke up, happened to look out the window, and noticed that there was a figure standing beside my vehicle, and I immediately arose to check it out. I decided that this guy was tampering with my vehicle, and so I had a pistol there. I don't have a concealed weapons permit, and I haven't had any formal training in firearms, but I grabbed my pistol, and as soon as I laid my hand on the gun, I realized that I was terrified about the notion of confronting this individual and perhaps having to shoot him over property, and decided that I would go out and protect my property, but I decided that I would, under no circumstances, unless I received fire or some other type of threat, that I would not shoot this person or even attempt to shoot him over property.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still faced with the dilemma of walking out into my yard and in the middle of the night having a confrontation with a criminal. And I think that I should have the right to do that. And it was a $1,000 winch that was attached to my truck, and I went out there with I think the proper mindset. But had I been involved in a circumstance where I had to shoot or fire, the thing that I had to consider was that in doing so, I would bring the weight of the state prosecutor with unlimited resources upon me, and certainly I would have ended up in some plea bargain where I would have had to plead guilty to some lesser crime for simply defending my property in my own yard.
Did you, let me ask first, did you call 911?
No, actually I didn't. My only telephone service at the time was a cell phone, and it was in my vehicle charging up.
Ah. Mm. Well.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't shoot, because you would have been in deep trouble. You're not entitled to use deadly force to protect a $1,000 winch on your truck. Even the new law is limited to attacks against your bodily integrity or threats to your life. So you thought rather intelligently under the circumstances, and I think that the fear of prosecution did you good service, because you would have been in deep trouble.
And that logic process... Go ahead. I'm sorry, Eric. Go ahead.
What am I supposed to do in that situation in the middle of the night where I'm faced with losing valuable property? Just write it off without even an attempt?
Well, you couldn't tell whether the guy had a weapon. You didn't know exactly what... there was no basis for thinking there was any danger to you. He wasn't trying to get inside your house. I suppose what you did is you went outside and you pointed the gun, right, and you told him to leave.
I think it would be entirely reasonable for me to go outside and under the assumption that probably this is going to result in a confrontation, because I lawfully, in my home, hadn't committed any crime. There's a criminal in my yard. I have a right, I would think, to go out and raise the confrontation in defense of my property. What happens after that is in the criminal's hands. And at that point, why should I have to consider the weight of the state?
If that's an interesting point, actually. If you were a police officer under those circumstances, and there would be certainly a tremendous potential for pointing the gun and then subsequently firing it. If the intruder made a move toward you and there was some basis to believe that he made a threat, what they call a threatening gesture, then if you actually shot under those circumstances, you might have a plausible claim of self-defense because you don't know whether he's armed or not armed. But obviously, you were quite intelligent, and as one of the previous speakers said, to try the tactic of avoidance. That is, you don't want to bring trouble on yourself, so you don't want to test the limits of the law by going outside and shooting. Now, if you actually pull the gun under those circumstances, I mean, that might be a reasonable step if you actually show the gun. But, you know, that one of the dangers of showing the gun to someone who is within some distance of you is if you show the gun, then the person can take it away from you. And that sometimes can increase the personal danger.
Yeah.
It's well, not...
I did show the gun, but I did maintain my distance. In fact, I maintained my distance.
And then he left. He left.
He did. He very wisely stepped back. And
yeah. Well, that was a good move.
Yeah, but it could have very easily gone the other way, and at which time I would have had the confrontation of the state prosecutor upon me, who has unlimited resources, and certainly, I think this falls directly in the gray area. It's not the white, it's not the black. It falls into the gray area, but we're forced to contemplate the financial burden of having to go to task with the state, and with whom very few of us have the resources with which to do that. And so, just in defense of my property, and in a situation like that, could have resulted in the defense of my person.
I see.
Right, but you sound like a good investor because obviously the expense that you would have incurred to defend yourself would have been far greater than $1,000.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Yeah,
Eric, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Let's talk now with KJ. KJ is with us from San Diego.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a two-part comment, actually. The professor brought up the case about Bernard Goetz. The thing about that case is, of course, it did have racial overtones due to the fact that Bernard Goetz is a white man and he did shoot a group of young black men. Another thing is that Bernard Goetz actually shot one of those individuals in the back. So that was kind of a gray situation. Another thing is that you're giving people who may, like Bernard Goetz, they really couldn't prove it, but from speaking with him and interviews and things, it kind of came out that he kind of had sensitivities toward young black males in general, as far as viewing them as being somewhat aggressive and or a threat to him. So you have that situation looming, and then also, you know, the call from the individual from Nevada, the sheriff, when mm-hmm. he said he agreed with the law but didn't agree particularly with the language. When you tell someone, I'm from the South, when you tell someone in the South to stand your ground, it has a different connotation to it in the fact that it doesn't really seem to cover the situation like the last caller was talking about when someone came in his yard or someone coming into your house. It has a connotation that if you're out with your family and someone mouths off or there's a group of individuals who are saying something to you, that you ought to stand your ground and become aggressive and or be the antagonist in that situation. You see where I'm going with that?
Mm-hmm. Those are very intelligent comments, in my opinion. I think the racial factor is obviously very serious in these cases, and I didn't even want to ask in the case of the last caller with the intruder in the backyard what the racial profile of the case was, because how the police handle this and how the prosecution handle this, it depends a great deal on the de facto racial relationship, whether it's a white shooting a black shooting a white.
Exactly.
This makes a tremendous difference, actually, in the way law enforcement responds. And there's no doubt about that. And I think you're absolutely right about the Goetz case, that the case was suffused with racial overtones.
Exactly.
KJ, right,
thank you.
Thanks for the phone call. We appreciate it. Let me read an email we got from Mark Wolf in Bethesda, Maryland. Please expand on the ramifications of taking advantage of this new law, i.e. responsibility for harm or damage done to the aggressor, more importantly to innocent bystanders. It's my understanding that one is responsible for each and every bullet fired, regardless of whether it hits its target or not.
Well, if you fire the gun and you're acting reasonably under the circumstances, then you're not going to be liable to the bystanders, because the action by the bystander against you would have to be for negligence. But if you're acting reasonably under the circumstances and responding to the risk, then you're not going to be subject to tort liability. That's not to say, and that's why some of your callers have been very astute about this, you might have legal problems even though you're technically not guilty. And what this new law does is talk about technical guilt and innocence. But you can have lots of hassles in the legal system as a result of using force that really fall below the threshold of actual liability. Just being sued or being prosecuted is a major, major headache.
George Fletcher, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
George Fletcher, Cardozo Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University School of Law. His new book, due out next year, is Justice in the Face of Enemy Fire. He joined us from our bureau in New York City.